Coming up next is the Professor James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, February 1st, 2007, and the first show of the month of February. A great deal of material to cover tonight, so I'll be talking a little faster than normal. First of all, an update on the new book. My new book is coming out, and I've picked a release date, a tentative release date of approximately February 10th. And so anyway, keep tuned to that. And also listen to my January 11th show dealing with repeatability in science. I believe it's the 11th of January where I gave the repeatability in science lecture as the main science topic. And that lecture, in fact, will be going on the book DVD. The book is coming out with a DVD and a lecture and some supporting material. Because I realized in sampling I realized that many people are going to have trouble actually understanding all the concepts of the book by just reading the book. So I've added a DVD lecture, which should clarify the topics for the average person. And remember, the new book is going to take an entirely new direction from anything you've seen me do in the past, although this has been an integral part of my past. So you'll be seeing a somewhat a new aspect of myself and my work. And this is something I've been working on pretty much all my life. So it'll be very interesting. I think there will be some eyebrows raised and some, anyway, February 10th is the tentative release date for the new book. No more said on that. Just a couple notes here on recent current events, and then I will get into the main science topic for tonight, which takes off on the same theme as the last few weeks. 2 weeks ago, I talked about the geopolitics of oil. And if you haven't listened to these, go back into the archives on my webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage. That's www.jmccsci.com, and listen to those shows because they are very important from a scientific point of view, the discussion of geopolitics of oil. And then last week I talked about the formation of chemicals in comet tails, and that includes oil and water. So remember, the Great Flood was not just a flood of water coming from above. It was a flood of naphtha, burning naphtha, which is the ancients' name for oil and tar and anything related to what we call petrol. And also the rocks coming in basically burning as this came in. So this had to be a horrendous sight. But that leads into tonight's topic. Is there oil on the moon? And other planets, but primarily the moon, as scientists start to think about going to the moon. Well, again, we'll see if they... I don't really think NASA has the capability of getting to the moon again. It's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of actually good work going on in the background as scientists, for example, do radar studies of the lunar surface. So there's a lot of good science going on in the background. Albeit the prospect of NASA actually getting it together to go to the moon with men, very doubtful. And they're already putting it off to the next generation. So they don't even plan to design or build anything in the current generation of scientists. But anyway, the main science topic for tonight in just a minute, is there oil on the moon? And of course, that's a kind of a pointed question because, of course, they say here that oil is due to fossil fuels, the decay of dinosaur bones and fern forests or what have you. Well, there weren't any of those on the moon, were there? So if there is oil on the moon, then how did it get there? Well, that's the topic for tonight's show. And of course, you already know the answer that comes from comet tails, but there's a lot of details involved in exactly how you might find it on the moon, what state it will be in, etc. So, first of all, a couple of quick recent events here. There's a recent report on global warming, and this was very much in the news this past week, as this was released, and this was a study meant to present to both the United States and global political community. And there was an uproar by some scientists because the report did not talk about the melting ice of Greenland and Antarctica. So I find this is rather funny because the original predictions of global warming were like a 0.1 degree rise in 50 years, and they thought this would be catastrophic. Well, this year alone, we were 18 degrees over normal up to about a week ago. So clearly, this was not predicted by what you call the global warming science scenario. And so I think it's rather comical that they try and now include the melting, the rapid and advanced melting of the Antarctic and Greenland ice caps, when in fact it was not predicted to be this rapid in their own models. So it's kind of a let's grab this and throw it into the sink too technique. So let's take the scenario. Scientists, 10, 12 years ago, began predicting global warming based on the greenhouse effect and emissions from CO2 emissions from burning coal and oil-based products. And they said that this would be, at their best predictions, 0.1 degree centigrade over a 50-year period. That was the original, what they called catastrophic, and they said over hundreds of years this could have devastating effects. Well, clearly, we have advanced far over that any of those predictions, and so clearly something else is going on. Clearly, the sun is the cause of this global warming, but what's causing the sun to heat up? And anyway, I'm going to talk in a minute also about people going around saying that the next solar cycle will be bigger than the last one, and presenting some data. Well, I'm going to show how the data they present, in fact, shows that the next solar cycle will be the lowest of the last six solar cycles. So based on the data they're presenting. So they're saying one thing and presenting some data, but the data that they're presenting actually shows the opposite, which I think is rather comical also. But back to the global warming report. Why are they trying to incorporate the melting ice caps now of Antarctica and Greenland? So this is more than what their original global warming prediction should have been. What's also very humorous about this is they're pounding their chest trying to get credit for making these predictions or pointing this out. But no one, I say no one, is making the following statement. We are seeing ice shelves breaking off of Antarctica. We're seeing them break off the North Polar Shield and also the Northern Canada, where very soon we will have a year-round shipping lane up north of Canada between there and the North Pole. And also Greenland is melting. The rivers of freshwater ice are coming off into the ocean around Greenland at a tremendous rate, a very accelerated rate. But here's the catch. Nobody, not a one of these scientists, is talking about capturing this water and making it useful. While the politicians are busy stirring up the next war in the Mideast, the water situation on Earth is becoming critical. All of this water is now melting and into the oceans, and we could be capturing this and bottling it and or putting it in large tankers or moving it in by other means, simply moving the icebergs, cutting them up with lasers into long sheets and moving them up to the, for example, the Sahara Desert, where this water is needed. So instead of letting it simply cause the ocean level to rise, we're talking vast, vast amounts of fresh water, enough to cause the entire Earth's oceans to rise maybe inches or feet. That is a tremendous amount of water, and nobody, not one of these scientists, is talking about taking that water and doing something with it. I've been talking about that on this show for a long time. I've been on other people's shows as guests and saying this over and over. Quit bickering about 1 degree or 2 degrees in the global warming scenario. Quit bickering over it being due to greenhouse gases or the sun. It's happening, folks. It is happening. It is happening right now. And due to the stupidity of scientists around the world dealing with this because they want their next grant and money, because they're so blind, they can't see that what they should really be talking about is the fact that we have to start taking this water and doing something with it. We have to bring it into land mass areas, vast land mass areas like the American Southwest, like the Sahara Desert, like the deserts that are in central China. We have to start getting this water and doing something with it. What I also see as amazing about this report is after it was issued, hundreds of scientists came out and said that they were pressured to modify their study by governments, including the United States government, the current regime. So why didn't they say that when they were being pressured? Why did they write their report, allow it to be modified, allow it to be printed, and only then come out and say something? I wonder if it had something to do with getting their funding for the next round of government supported funding. I really don't have much respect for many of the scientists who depend on government funding, don't really say what's on their mind, and then afterwards make a claim like that, that somehow they were limited or their study was altered only after they've got their next round of funding. I wonder about people like that. The next topic: mega marsupials once roamed Australia. This is out of Reuters. And the lions, kangaroos, as big as trucks, wombats the size of a rhinoceros, it says, roamed Australia's outback. Get this. This is the part that I thought, I just had to laugh. It says, roamed Australia's outback before being killed off by fires lit by arriving humans 50,000 years ago. Now, wait a minute. The way the standard story goes, man crossed the Bering Strait only 10,000 years ago to populate the Western Hemisphere, but now they have them 50,000 years ago in Australia to kill off this group of animals. Now, they found the animal remains almost perfectly without any devastation or any trauma in deep caves. These were three deep caves in the Nullarbor Desert east of the west coast city of Perth in 2002. These were discovered. So these were Ice Age Australian animals, and they were found in deep caves, all of these different animals, some of which ate the other ones for a living, all living harmoniously in these deep caves. 69 species of mammals, birds, reptiles, including the new species of giant kangaroo, some standing as tall as 9 feet tall, all found their way into this cave and died. Gee, I wonder if that could have been during a passage of one of our Planet X type members. And also, they put this at 50,000 years ago. And we all know that the mastodons, some of them, it is admitted by the experts, were in existence up to 4,000 years ago. And this is getting into the realm of Velikovsky dating, that the big issue came down, the actual beginning of the Ice Age was probably more like 4,000 to maybe 5,000 years ago. And we are just coming out of that Ice Age right now. My weather book goes into great detail about that. And of course, that's why we're truly having global warming right now, because we're coming out of the last stages of that Ice Age, which was caused by Earth passing through a comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights. We had a tremendous influx of oil and water, and we were blocked from the sun for over a month. Can you imagine what that would do to Earth? The lack of solar energy that would drive our temperatures down, causing an ice age. That's what drove these animals into these caves for survival, all of them standing around. And we've seen this in other places around the world, where animals which would normally be hunting one another, were living in the same cave harmoniously while something was going on up above. So clearly, now the story that they present in this article is that these animals just kind of wandered into these caves, were just kind of hanging out there together because some people lit some fires up above. Now, we've seen animals in Africa, we've seen people lighting fires or just wildfires. Animals don't run into caves, they run around, they try and get away from the fire. So this idea that all of a sudden all of these 69 species of animals went down into these caves to hang out together in harmony until they died, is almost ridiculous. And don't you think maybe some of them would have eaten some of the other ones, like the lions, for food down there? While they were waiting and standing around looking at each other and starving to death. I can't believe that they print this stuff, that because man arrived, and then they put it at 50,000 years ago. I mean, this is so ridiculous. This is like somebody making up a fairy tale and then having the nerve to talk about it. Now, okay, the next topic is something that has appeared in both the popular press, on NASA science pages, etc. And I think somebody's trying to get some funding here once again. The data that is presented shows the geomagnetic activity peaks over the last, 11 solar cycles going back into the 1800s. And then it shows the solar maxima intensity 6 years later and how the geomagnetic activity typically predicts the peak of the solar activity. So at any rate, they show the graph and then predict that the next solar cycle 24, which will peak in around the year 2011 or 12, will in fact be the largest one on record. But if you look at the data, which I'm looking at right now, and I will try and post this on my page and write a little article up at the top of the page, it's clear that solar cycle 19, which occurred in around the late 1950s, let's say, was in fact the largest solar cycle in history going all the way back to the 1800s. And if you look at the data that they're presenting, the current geomagnetic cycle, which we are in right now, and which has peaked, by the way, and is going down, would show that the next solar cycle will be the smallest of the past, two of the smallest of the past six solar cycles. In other words, there was only one solar cycle that was slightly smaller And that was the one that occurred in around 1970, in the late 1960s. That would have been the smallest solar cycle of the past six. The one coming up, according to this data, would be second smallest to that one of the past six solar cycles. In fact, you could go back another, so it'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, you could go back the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 solar cycles. So out of the last six, the upcoming solar cycle would be the smallest, except for just one that occurred around 1968. So the prediction, based on the data they're presenting, I just find it comical that they don't think anybody's going to look at the data they're presenting. But they've gone on radio shows and on publications on science, on all of the standard NASA outlets, stating that Earth's next geomagnetic cycle will be the largest in a long time, which is simply not true, according to their very own data. The World Bank. For those people who are not familiar with what the World Bank is, it's an organization that supposedly gets its funding from a number of sub-nations, one being the United States, and they loan money out to third world nations for development. Sounds like a great deal. And what we found out, however, is it's the biggest con job. Not only is it the biggest con job, it is the old protection racket, and it turns out that, as I always say, the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. And here's how it works. The undeveloped countries, of which the United States is one, by the way, in their eyes, but the undeveloped countries, they give a loan to. Now, first of all, this outfit doesn't have any more money than you or me put together. It's just the funny money. So they go into a country, they say, we're going to give you a $70 million loan for development, and then they go in and they have assistants who spec out a project, like building a bridge or a road system or something like that. Well, that's great, but then they expect repayment with interest. In the typical third world nation, now the other part of the equation is, in the background, around on the left-hand side, the CIA is going in, maneuvering with the political structure in the country to make sure that the right politicians are in the right offices to make this deal happen. And so, okay, the loan gets cut, the money goes into the country, but there's no oversight as to where that money goes. So it simply greases a bunch of people's pockets. Many times the projects, there's no follow-up to find out if these projects were completed or if they had any economic effect on the populace. But be that as it may, the end result is the populace has to be taxed to pay back this loan to the World Bank. A loan plus interest, which of course they know for a fact this country will not be able to pay back. And so then when the country defaults, then they send in the international corporations, which are the buddies of the World Bank, like Wolfowitz, who is now head of the World Bank. He sends in his buddies, organizations, and businesses to help with development. And so then what's the name of the game? Resource grabbing. And it's a way of getting to the resources of these countries to steal them, basically, and say, now since you defaulted on your loan, we need to assist you in getting these resources and getting your development up to speed so you can pay us back. That's the name of the game. It's the old protection racket on a worldwide basis, and they've been doing this to third world countries. That's one reason why they're very upset with Chavez in Venezuela, is because he is starting to give his own loans based on his oil profits, to give loans to third world countries so they can actually develop and build development projects which will benefit the people, not the businesses, the international business that come in from outside to rape and pillage the resources of these poor underdeveloped third world nations. So at any rate, just a quick note on that. The next topic is somewhat along the same line. While I found it comical that they were, because Bush in his State of the Union said something about developing wind and biofuel, I thought that was rather comical. And by the way, he caught a lot of heat from his oil buddies in the Mideast. But be that as it may, somebody had the nerve to actually call him a green president. But in the background, if you had any doubts, at the same time, he was mustering up what is known as the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. This is with a company called Areva out of France, an international energy giant, which builds, manages, and does complete oversight of nuclear facilities. Now, look at the rest of the equation here. The Mideast and Iran, they're trying to drive Iran back from nuclear development, claiming that they are doing this solely for the purpose of developing nuclear bombs. But if Iran develops nuclear power, they will be able to sell it on the international market and undercut the Areva and large international corporations. There's a huge surge right now going on around the world to bring nuclear power back. You find political manipulation in Germany. Now, the reason this is important is because the nuclear power industry has been sitting at bay for probably 20 years, not really building any new plants. And they want that to change. They want the political scenario to change for nuclear power. But if small countries like Iran can develop it, they can also sell it on the world market. So guess what the deal was that the Bushes cut with the Iranians, or want to cut? If the deal is, either we're going to attack you if you keep developing this nuclear power, but if you stop, we will give you nuclear power. We will give you nuclear power plants and maintain them for you if you stop your development. Now, wait a minute. They're claiming Iran is doing this for nuclear warfare solids to build nuclear bombs. And they want Iran to stop all development of nuclear facilities. But if they stop, they will give them nuclear facilities. Isn't there kind of a little contradiction there? So, and of course, the real reason is because if Iran develops nuclear power and is successful, they will be able to sell that technology on the third world market and definitely undercut the big monopoly conglomerates like Areva. So if you have any doubts about Bush or the Clintons being green presidents or potential presidents, they're all involved in these global initiatives, Clinton having his own, the Bill Clinton guy, the Clinton Global Initiative, and now GW with his Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which is basically a way for political entities to create monopolies for large international, multinational energy corporations like Areva from France, as I said, who sells, markets, maintains, etc., the nuclear facilities around the world, and they want to build another 20 nuclear power plants in the United States over the next 10 years. So if you think that all of this is someplace else, not at all. They want to build another 20 of these babies over here, and already they don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. The nuclear waste is the biggest pollution problem on the planet, because eventually that is going to come back to haunt us, and it will destroy any possibility of life on this planet. The military has already been dumping large quantities of nuclear waste from their nuclear fleet. They've been dumping this waste down into crevices in the ocean, some of it without even being placed in canisters. They're just dumping it into the ocean. So anyway, not good. Not good. These people really all have to go. I've said that before. We need a planet with real leadership where the leaders are bringing us in the direction that is right for people, for humanity, not right for, and that, of course, that flies right in the face of these multinational corporations who don't care about pollution, who don't care about anything but world domination and profit. On to the next topic. Okay, I covered that. Oh, just this is another laughable topic. I didn't hear this myself, but there's a bunch of new, I would call them yo-yos or bozos, let's see, you take your pick, claiming to be experts. These new international group of scholars and scientists have come to the conclusion that there was ancient catastrophes. And, of course, these are newly found facts that will just amaze and astound you, that there were ancient civilizations that went under due to a catastrophe. And they throw in everything, including the kitchen sink. Oh, the 2012 is going to be the Mayan calendar, the end of the world. I call 2012 the next Y2K. It's the next date that somebody's picked to try and make a big hype story out of. And, of course, along with this, they say that Earth will go through catastrophic changes when Earth crosses the galactic plane. Now, let me explain something. First of all, the solar system, which has Earth as a tiny speck of dust out in orbit around the sun, the movement of this solar system that we live in relative to the galactic plane is so minute over the spatial coordinates of the galaxy that all of a sudden on a certain day in 2012, Earth isn't going to all of a sudden cross the galactic plane and explosions are going to occur and waves coming out of the galactic nucleus. These claims are being made by people who have PhDs in physics. Obviously, this is a ploy by disinformation people to draw the topics, draw attention away from my success, for one. But we're back to the same goofy stories. And of course, when asked, they'll tell you all day, talk to you all day about Planet X, although none of them have ever been heard of in this arena before. They claim to be studying, to have been studying this for 30 years, 30 years of research. Well, isn't it funny that they waited till 2007 to say anything? I think that's rather humorous. Don't you think that if they discovered this 30 years ago, they would have said something? Or maybe the political climate just wasn't right. You know, I just have to laugh at these people. But what's comical is that these people are being promoted on many major airwaves, which tells you right away that they are being promoted by disinformation crews with a brand new DVD produced. And, you know, who put the money up for this? Who's getting them onto the mainstream news media with this story that they really don't want on mainstream news media? But you got to understand that when it's designed so that when the average guy listens to this, they in the back of their mind, they think, this is so much garbage, I'm not even going to listen to it. It's the old, let's take a story, twist it, make it bizarre and stupid and laughable, and some people will buy the DVD, you know, but whatever. This is a controlled disinformation ploy. Well, I hope people who listen to this show are smart enough to see through all of that. But the other part of this is that there's a lot of people out there who really haven't heard about all of, you know, the Planet X scenario and that type of thing. And once these disinformation groups go out there with their BS and start pounding the pavement, so to speak, with their ridiculous story, that's going to wake some people up and they're going to go start looking and they're going to end up at my webpage. Yes, thank you very much. And once they're at my webpage, then I've gained new audience. I've gained new listeners, people who are going to read my books and understand what's really going on, and they're going to get the lectures and the information about disinformation, how it works. And so that's the only good thing I can tell you about it, is that a lot of these listeners who are just waking up for the first time are going to end up at my webpage. And they're going to be confused at first because they're going to end up at all of the other disinformation pages out there. They're going to try and sort through it, but ultimately the ones that are intended to understand what's going on, the ones that really search out, the ones that really want to get a grip on what's really going on, those people will get to my page and become students of the real information. And I have been working on this for 30 years, and I'll tell you, these new yo-yos, nobody has ever heard of them before. So I always get a kick out of when people go, oh, 30 years of research. Yeah, right. Well, where's all of their references? Where's their paper trail? It ain't there. It isn't there. Never was there. So anyway, enough. But I just wanted to mention, I thought that was rather comical that another group is now on the market attempting to market garbage. Kind of stinks of the old Zetaquack stuff. Same garbage, different flavor. So at any rate, before the main topic, science topic here, I just want to review for those people. I want to give you the method of getting a hold of my material. There's three ways to do this. There's the website, which I recommend. It has all the archives of my past radio shows, etc. www.jmcci.com. That's the abbreviated form of jmcanniscience.com, but don't try and spell that, because if you misspell it, you're going to end up at one of those CIA disinformation sites. Once again, jmcciscci.com, just 7 letters, no dots or dashes, jmcciscci.com. Also, the 800 number, 800-983-5622, has information on the Berkey water filter and the 4-book set with 2 videos. 800-983-5622, and that's basically a credit card ordering line for, as I said, the Berkey water filter and the 4-book set with 2 videos, and those come with the free radio, by the way. I just want to reiterate that the Berkey water filter, which I think everybody should have. If you don't have one, I would suggest getting it today, because the worldwide water shortage is coming down on us very quickly. And after these things happen, you're not going to be able to order anything, let alone a water filter. So once again, and also by mail order, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. That's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And the mail order address, what I would suggest for newcomers to this show, $25 will get you the weather book, 300-page book that summarizes the previous ones, and of course that includes free shipping. For $60, you can get the 4-book set, and that includes shipping, The Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, Surviving Planet X Passage, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and the weather book for $60 at that address. So once again, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota 55392. And people do order the Berkey water filter. Those are $315, and you get the free shortwave radio. That's the Berkey with 2 filters, black Berkey filters, and 2 extra, which you will need. So on to the main science topic for the night. Is there water? No, I'm sorry. Back up. Is there oil on the moon? And now, oil is a little different than water. In a scenario like the moon, if you had water on the moon, much of that would evaporate away because there's not enough atmospheric pressure to hold the water. So it would evaporate away or possibly turn into some form of permafrost, possibly under the surface. But it's not like it's readily available in lakes or oceans. But oil is a bit different. Oil has a consistency that could maintain, and of course not the more volatile forms like natural gas, it would evaporate away very quickly from the surface of the moon, especially in the hot daytime when the surface of the moon is baking in the hot solar with the sun baking on it. But tar and other thicker forms of oil could certainly exist on the moon. Now, we've seen comet nuclei with, I believe it was it Borealy? Comet Borealy that had the thick tar surface, black tar-like substance, hydrocarbon surface, basically baked on it. And now that's very interesting because remember last week I talked about comets developing oil and other chemicals, water, oil, hydrocarbons, everything up to ammonia. All of these have been observed in comet tails, and these chemicals form as the comet is drawing material in, atomic material, and possibly organic molecules that are in outer space. The comet is an electrical discharge, and it's like the nucleus becomes charged. It becomes like a vacuum cleaner in outer space, drawing all of this material in. The larger comets have enough surface gravity to hold this material, but in the case of some of these smaller comets, when the electron beam comes in from the sunward side, it burns these materials onto the surface, especially the hydrocarbons in the tar. So to find a comet nucleus covered with tar, black tar material, is not that unusual. So let's talk about the scenario that I talked about last week. When Earth passes through a large comet tail, as we did many thousands of years ago, that event that created the Ice Age drew Earth into the last ice age. As we pass through a comet tail, as the ancients tell us, for 40 days and 40 nights, it rained. And remember, there's a lot of scientists today, I just have to laugh, that they are talking about, oh, this land bridge broke and there's a flood came, a big lake or ocean spilled down into the Mediterranean, and they say, oh, that's what the ancient flood was all about. How ridiculous. It is very clear from all the ancient texts that the rain came from above, and it clearly came from outer space. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and along with it, it was not just rain, it was oil, burning naphtha, and the brimstone were the rocks, the streams, the meteor streams that accompany the comet, coming in, and of course, as they hit the atmosphere, would heat up and ignite the naphtha that was coming in. So this was a big flaming mess, to put it briefly. And of course, we were blocked from sunlight as we were in the comet tail, so the water froze as it hit the ground, creating the great glaciers that covered Earth. There was a polar shift of about 30 degrees where the poles shifted due to the interaction. And by the way, just to mention this new group of yo-yos, they're saying, oh, there's a polar shift due to Earth crossing the galactic plane. What a bunch of garbage. As I said, there's no magical moment when some planet crosses the galactic plane. As I said before, I'm not going to go into that. I don't want to become diverted with all that garbage. But at any rate, as Earth plowed through the comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights, and that would be about the time for a big comet for us to pass through a large comet tail, because they're millions of miles wide, a large comet tail. The moon would go along with us. It would pass through the same comet tail. So the influx of water, of hydrocarbons, of other chemicals would occur on the moon. The only difference with the moon is it doesn't have an atmosphere. So after the Earth-Moon system leaves this comet tail and starts to recover, Earth, of course, is now glaciated. Man has been driven back to the cave ages. Ancient civilizations were destroyed. And as it comes out the other side, the moon, what's going to happen to the moon? It doesn't have an atmosphere. So much of the water that it accumulated is going to vaporize off the surface of the planet, and that should happen fairly quickly. The oils, however, will stay. So it is my prediction that we will find goodly amounts of oil on the moon. Now, this is going to cause a little bit of a problem for standard science that claims that oil, in fact, is due to fossil fuel or fossil decay and the decay of fern forests, etc. Now, I also find this comical that when you get coal, and Velikovsky made a very good explanation of this, that the coal pits and the coal mines, which are in deep in the Earth's core, I had a technical difficulty here. The coal pits, some of them are deep underground. How did all of this ground get on top of what used to be fern forests? Clearly, there had to be some radical changes. The same thing is true of salt mines. We have salt mines that are way underground. How did this salt from ancient oceans get underground? Excuse me, I had to take a sip of water there. Clear my throat. How did these vast coal reserves, salt reserves, get so far underground, sometimes miles underground? Clearly, a lot has happened to Earth. It isn't just this planet that's been floating around the sun for 4.5 billion years, and everything is just the same. We have had massive buildups of matter over what used to be fern forests. But the point is, what Velikovsky said about coal, and this is what Ignatius Donnelly said also, who grew up in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. The vast ocean waves caused either by tidal waves from a passing comet or possibly tsunamis from when the Earth was shaking and the volcanic eruptions were going off. Anyway, these vast waves would come off the ocean and literally take all of the vegetation and pile it up. Now, we actually saw this in Madagascar, where a vast, very powerful hurricane came in, and with very large storm surges, and actually the wave took the tropical plant material and piled it up in giant piles. And Velikovsky's point was that the fern forest never had a chance to decay. And of course, that's the claim of standard science, that oil is a result of decaying plant matter. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth, because the whole idea doesn't make sense. When you pick up a piece of coal, it's simply layered vegetation. It's all stacked up. You see the leaves, you see the plant matter all stacked up together. Some coal has more oil content than others. So when you burn the coal, the water has been pressed out of the plant material, but it never had time to decay. So you see fossilized in the coal the leaves, the plant material, just the way it was laid down by the vast ocean waves. And the ancients are very clear. In the Colburn, for example, it's very clear that the oceans rose up and came across the land. In the Popol Vuh, the Mayan traditional book, it's very clear that Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, which was the comet Venus, by the way, drew up the oceans, and the oceans rose up and came across the land, killing everything, including the vast majority of the population. But in doing so also, it took the vegetation and piled it up into vast piles, which became coal. Under the pressure, the water was basically squeezed out, and then in the rain of oil that was coming in at the same time, the coal, the plant matter, was saturated with oil. It soaked up the oil, which replaced the water. And so that's why a lot of coal has oil in it. And when you burn it, it's a tremendously hot fire. That's why they use it for stoking, for making steel, etc., because coal makes a tremendously hot fire. But at any rate, back to the moon. So this very same activity occurred on the moon, and most of this oil should still be on the moon, sinking into the ground. So there should be a vast amount of oil on the moon when we do get there with private enterprise. Certainly, I don't expect NASA to ever get to the moon. In fact, it's in their plans not to get to the moon. The whole plan is to spend as much money not getting to the moon and prevent the public from getting into space. Remember, that's NASA's behind-the-scene goal. And you have the Tier 2 scientists running around doing their studies, like radar studies of the lunar surface, and the intention of the people controlling NASA is to keep the public from space and keep space for the private playground of guess who. But at any rate, these scientists will simply not wake up, because guess what? Their weekly paycheck depends on them continuing to be led around by the nose, by the rings in their nose called funding and a government paycheck. 99.9% of all PhDs work for the government. They don't like hearing this. They don't like somebody believing that, they don't like people believing that what they are doing is controlled and manipulated and really not going for the greater good that they believe it is. At any rate, the situation, once other countries get to the moon, they're going to realize that there are vast quantities of oil there. But here's the other point. What can you do with oil on the moon? Well, oil is the basis for carbon fiber, resins. Basically, it would be we would have the ability to manufacture housing there. In fact, I found this comical too, that NASA is just beginning to wake up to use carbon fiber composites for space housing, because it's lighter weight, it's strong, etc. So, of course, Bert Rutan had been using this for ages, and now, just this past couple of months, NASA has woken up to the fact that, gee, you could use carbon fiber for the main housing of space housing for astronauts or spacefaring human beings. So we could use the native oil on the moon, but nobody at NASA knows about this. They don't understand it, so they're not planning on it, and it would be a vast resource. They're looking for water on the moon to try and use as a resource for both fuel, for oxygen, hydrogen, and chemical rocket engines, and they're also looking for water for drinking, so that there would be a water source once they get there, because of course water is fairly heavy, and if you have to carry your water with you, then it's just another payload expense in the mission. But at any rate, the oil is, I would say, on the moon. Now let's take a planet like Mars. Mars, which also underwent the same interaction with a comet. So there should be vast reservoirs of oil and other chemicals on Mars. So I find it interesting that the latest reports from the Mars orbiter is that there are organic chemicals, including methane, being measured on Mars. Well, wouldn't it make sense that if Mars went through this interaction with the comet only a number of thousand years ago, and with the Martian atmosphere being as faint as it is, that the methane and lighter gases, hydrocarbon gases, would still be bleaching off the deposits that were put there just a few thousand years ago? That makes far more sense than imagining that there are cows grazing up there giving off methane. And of course, there are still disputes over the data, because some scientists don't believe that Mars could possibly have methane. Other scientists are saying there could be biological life in microbial form in the Martian surface and therefore causing methane. So the argument goes on, but what I would say is, number one, it's very possible that this is coming from the residue from the oil deposits that came just a few thousand years ago. And Mars, too, would have significant oil deposits as it went through the comet tail potentially just like Earth did. So it's hard to say if Mars spent that much time in the comet tail, or did the comet simply pass by. There again is another factor, an unknown factor. What we do know from ancient text is that as the comet Venus, what the ancients called Quetzalcoatl, as that comet passed by the planet Mars, the ancients were able to look up in the night sky and see the comet attach electrically. That was this big electrical snake-like protrusion. And they thought it was a snake, or they typified it as a snake, because the auroras around the planet up in the atmosphere made the discharge look like a snake. In other words, the extension went out and was moving back and forth like a big tentacle snake in space, and the auroras around the planet, just put your hand and arm out and imagine your arm kind of wiggling back and forth, and at the end your hand is wrapped around that planet and your hand is the auroral displays up in the upper atmosphere of Mars, and this is all moving back and forth, and they saw the comet extract the oceans and atmosphere of Mars, going from a blue planet to the red planet we see today. The ancients saw this. And I'm seeing that, I'm not quite out of time. The ancients saw this. So at that point, Mars was not in the comet tail. And so maybe Venus just passed by and Mars did not spend that much time in the comet tail as we did. We must have gone, as they say, as the ancients talk about, for 40 days and 40 nights in that comet tail. That's a long time, and so we had a tremendous pollution event. That's why, once again, there are vast oceans of oil all over Earth. That's why the oil is in huge deposits, for example, at the base of the Caspian Sea. The Russians are already pumping at that oil deposit. That's why the U.S. also wants to get into Iran, is because their original ploy to put a pipeline across Afghanistan, that ploy did not work because the people in the out country of Afghanistan, it's a many thousand mile long pipeline and they can't keep it operating. The next best, actually a much better solution, is to have a pipeline that goes from the Caspian Sea down to the Gulf. And guess what's right in the middle of that path? Iran and Tehran. In fact, Tehran is exactly in the middle of that path. So the question, is there oil on the moon? Yes. Is there water all over Earth because we pass through a comet tail? Yes. And is there oil all over the Earth due to Earth passing through a comet tail? Yes. Is coal with its oil the result of the vast comet interactions that have occurred in the history of this Earth? Yes. At any rate, I'm once again out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and my voice is leaving me too. Hopefully it'll be back by next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.